Conservative? You bet. Controversial? Right again. It's time to squabble on the Jim Benson Show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Jim Benson Show, conservative talk radio covering the issues that concern you here on the BBS Radio Network. If you'd like to call into the show, the phone number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Prominent in the news this week has been, of course, the impeachment trial of President Trump. At the end of last week, lawyers for the president were making their case for the president in the Senate. In previous days, last week, the Democrats made their case for convicting the president of wrongdoing in a phone conversation last year with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who has denied that Trump has pressured him into investigate 2020 presidential candidate Joe Biden and his son for corruption. The key allegation and element on which this ridiculous political sham is based. The impeachment of the president has one purpose, to turn the public against Trump and get him removed from office, either by the U.S. Senate via the impeachment trial or later this year at the ballot box. Frauds like the rabid Trump haters and House impeachment managers, Representatives Adam Schiff and Gerald Nadler, know that if they appear sincere and persistent in promoting the lies and distortions they are using to smear Trump, people, some people at least, will believe their accusations are valid and justified. It's the old adage, tell a lie often enough and people will believe it. The Democrats know they have no real case against Trump, so they are simply inventing one, knowing that the Democratic Party's propaganda wing, the mainstream media, will back them up. I expect Trump to be acquitted, but the slur and smear of impeachment will be used by his enemies to taunt and belittle him well into and after this year's elections. The objective is to destroy Trump's support with as many voters as possible, voters they despise but hope to manipulate into voting against Trump, or at least not voting for him. And not only that, but evidence has emerged indicating Trump was set up for the impeachment by Obama holdovers within his administration in yet another attempt to get him removed from office. You're familiar with the story about the CIA analyst who is the so-called whistleblower, who went to Adam Schiff's people with the story that Trump was somehow engaging in illegal and improper behavior in his phone conversation last year with Ukrainian President Zelensky. You know about Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, the Army officer who testified before Congress that Trump's behavior was somehow improper and so on. Now, RealClearInvestigations.com has a lengthy article indicating that this was all a plot against Trump. Surprise, surprise. Here's Rush Limbaugh on his January 22nd radio program summing up the Real Clear Investigation story. Play soundbite one, please.
Real Clear Investigations whistleblower overheard in 2017 discussing with ally how to remove Trump. Barely 2 weeks after Trump took office, Eric Sciarmella, the CIA analyst who everybody knows is the whistleblower, was overheard in the White House discussing with another staffer how to remove Trump from office. This according to former colleagues. Sources told Real Clear Investigations the staffer with whom Sciarmella was speaking was Sean Misko. Both Sciarmella and Misko were Obama holdovers working in the Trump White House on foreign policy and national security issues, and both expressed anger over Trump's America First foreign policy, which was a sea change from Obama's approach to international affairs. Well, doesn't that tell you a lot? Here comes Trump, America First, and the Obama people don't like that? America First is a problem? It's such a problem, we got to get rid of Trump? This is 2 weeks after the inauguration. Just days after Trump was sworn in, these two were already talking about trying to get rid of him, said a White House colleague overheard the conversation. They weren't just bent on subverting his agenda, the official said. They were plotting to actually have him removed from office. Sean Misko left the White House last summer. He was still there. Trump never got rid of these schlubs. He was still there last summer and went over and joined Adam Schiff's committee. Schiff, the whistleblower, and Sean Misko cooked this up. It is why I say when this blows up on them, when there's not a conviction, what's next? Because there's going to be something. They can't let this next 10 months go by without some Trump scandal, some Trump allegation. There's also a reference in this Real Clear Politics story to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Oh, say, can you see the super patriot guy? Listen to what this says about Vindman. Vindman is, by the way, we're pretty sure that Vindman's a guy that was on the phone call and then reported it to Sharamella, who then called Schiff. This is shocking. It was terrifying. What I heard was unbelievable. Of course, then they released a transcript. There was nothing to it. Before he was detailed to the White House, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman served in the U.S. Army, where he once received a reprimand from a superior officer for bad-mouthing and ridiculing America in front of Russian soldiers that his unit was training with during a joint 2012 exercise in Germany. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Hickman, complained that Vindman, who was then a major, was apologetic of American culture. He laughed about Americans not being educated or worldly, and really talked up Obama, really promoted globalism to the point of it being uncomfortable. Vindman was a partisan Democrat at least as far back as 2012, said Hickman, now retired. Don't let the uniform fool you. Vindman is a political activist in uniform. This whole thing's a setup, as everything in the effort to get Donald Trump has been a setup. Everything's a setup. It's all set up, beginning with Trump-Russia collusion. Every aspect, every individual part of this is the result of a setup.
Remember that the way the political left operates is to accuse their opponents of what they are doing to distract attention to them and smear their enemies. It's outrageous hypocrisy, but you see it all the time. You've all heard a lot and seen a lot about Democratic presidential hopeful former Vice President Joe Biden's activities in the Ukraine and his son Hunter getting something like $50,000 a month as a board member of the Ukrainian energy company Burisma, and Biden bragging about getting a Ukrainian prosecutor fired investigating Burisma. I'm sorry, bragging about getting a Ukrainian prosecutor investigating Burisma fired by withholding U.S. aid to Ukraine. No problem with that, according to his lackeys in the mainstream media. Biden is dogged by corruption allegations, and his son Hunter has made vast amounts of money, say critics, as a result of Joe Biden's activities while serving as vice president. Biden himself and his wife have also gotten rich off book deals and speeches since Biden left political office. Let's listen to a CNBC story which ran last July, I believe, and which is on YouTube, about how Joe Biden made his millions after leaving office. Please play soundbite two.
Joe Biden used to joke about being the poorest member of Congress.
Don't hold it against me that I don't own a single stock or bond. Don't hold it, I have no savings account.
Now, he's among the richest Democrats running for president. Life after the vice presidency fattened Biden's wallet. He and his wife, Jill, made more than $15 million in 2017 and 2018 combined. That's easily the most out of the 2020 Democratic primary candidates who have released their taxes. And Biden's sudden explosion of wealth doesn't quite square with the image he's pitched to Americans for years.
All my time in public life, from which I've gotten involved, I've been referred to as middle-class Joe. It's not always meant as a compliment. Let me say this simply and clearly, and I mean this. The country wasn't built by Wall Street bankers, CEOs, and hedge fund managers. It was built by you. It was built by the great American middle class.
Biden may once have been part of that middle class. He's definitely not anymore. 2016 was Biden's last year as an elected official after more than four decades. The Bidens made about $400,000 that year. That's more than six times the U.S. median income. But Biden really started making money after he left the Obama administration in 2017. The couple raked in more than $11 million that year. They made another $4.6 million last year. They now say they have between $2.2 million and $8 million in assets. They paid about a third of their adjusted gross income in federal income taxes in 2017. Last year, they paid about $1.5 million in taxes. So, where did all that money come from? Mostly books and speaking fees. The Bidens have two S corporations that get paid for their book deals and speaking gigs. Those 2017 Trump tax cuts that are a punching bag for Biden and his 2020 rivals? They gave a 20% tax break to owners of businesses like the Bidens have. The S Corps made about $10 million combined in 2017. They took in about $3.2 million last year. Joe Biden's book, Promise Me, Dad, came out in November 2017. It followed the 2015 death of his son, Beau. Jill Biden's book, Where the Light Enters, was released in May 2019. Joe Biden promoted his book with a tour in 2017 and 2018. He made tens of thousands of dollars for just about every stop. He raked in as much as $106,000 for one stop. And fees for nearly 20 paid speeches, mostly at universities, in those 2 years ranged from $66,000 to $190,000. The Bidens seem to be enjoying their new wealth. They're renting a lavish 12,000-square-foot house in Virginia. They also bought a $2.7 million beach house in Delaware since Joe Biden left the Obama administration. Their charitable giving also rose along with their income. The Bidens put about $275,000, or 6% of their adjusted gross income, toward charities last year. In 2017, they gave more than $1 million to charity, about 9% of their income. That was up from 1.5% in 2016. But Biden's riches could cause some headaches for him. While he has led just about every national and state poll since he jumped into the race, his lead has started to shrink. The Democratic contenders have broadly focused on helping workers and reining in companies and the wealthy. Biden has been less aggressive toward business than most of his rivals. And he is already facing heat for being too cozy with the rich.
Recently, in remarks to a group of wealthy donors, as you were speaking about the problem of income inequality in this country, you said, we shouldn't, quote, demonize the rich. You said, nobody has to be punished. No one's standard of living would change. Nothing would fundamentally change. What did you mean by that?
What I meant by that is, look, Donald Trump thinks Wall Street built America. Ordinary middle-class Americans built America.
We reached out to the Biden campaign about whether Biden's riches clash with his campaign message. A spokesman said, fighting for working families has been the defining cause of Joe Biden's life. He added that Biden is running to restore the American middle class, with everybody in on the deal this time. It remains to be seen whether Biden still tries to craft an image around middle-class Joe as he continues his campaign, especially if he wins the Democratic nomination and takes on President Trump in 2020. The president is a self-professed billionaire who hasn't released his tax returns. He broke with decades of precedent in refusing to release them. 10 years of Trump tax returns from the 1980s and 1990s obtained by the New York Times show massive losses for the president's businesses. He didn't pay federal income taxes in 8 of those 10 years. And since Trump was first running for president, Biden has cast him as out of touch with everyday Americans.
How can there be pleasure in saying you're fired? He's trying to tell us he cares about the middle class. Give me a break. That's a bunch of malarkey.
Well, we could go into whether Trump should release his tax returns or not. I can understand why he doesn't, if nothing – for no other reason, just that he knows he'll be attacked and viciously accused of all kinds of things. I'm not for destroying the rich, like – or at least some of these people claim they are, who are rich themselves. But be that as it may, let's move on here. Here's a short clip from YouTube recording Joe Biden bragging at where else but the Council on Foreign Relations – about getting the Ukrainian prosecutor fired. It's accompanied with the following text. Quote, in 2016, Ukrainian prosecutor General Viktor Shokin, in his investigation of corruption involving Burisma Holdings, a natural gas company, identified Hunter Biden as the recipient of over $3 million from the company. Not wanting this corruption exposed, Joe Biden has swung into action, using U.S. loan guarantees as hostage while demanding Shokin be fired. Joe Biden now brags about his actions in this matter. Close quote. Please play soundbite 3.
I remember going over convincing our team, our others, to convincing us that we should be providing for loan guarantees. And I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. Said, "No, we're not going to give you the $1 billion." They said, "You have no authority. You're not the president." The president said, "I said, call him." I said, "I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion." I said, "You're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here." And I think it was 6 hours. I looked. I said, "I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money." Well, son of a bitch, got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid.
Joe Biden denies doing anything wrong here and says every major media organization has exonerated him in this matter. Let's listen to some more information involving allegations of Biden family questionable financial dealings. This time we're hearing from Fox's Swamp Watch program with Steve Hilton in 2018, featuring Peter Schweitzer, author of the book Secret Empires: How the American Political Class Hides Corruption and Enriches Family and Friends. Schweitzer has another book which is just out this month titled Profiles in Corruption: Abuse of Power by America's Progressive Elite. Play soundbite 4, please.
We've told you before about the sleazy business deals that Vice President Joe Biden's son Hunter conducted while his father was in office. Well, tonight, in a very special Swamp Watch, we have some shocking new details. Joining me now to explain, author of Secret Empires, How the American Political Class Hides Corruption and Enriches Family and Friends, the great Peter Schweitzer. Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm great, Steve. Great to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to say, take it away. You have the information. Let's hear it.
Well, the story really begins on June 28th when Devin Archer, business partner to Hunter Biden, is convicted in a New York court involving a bond scheme where they fraudulently sold $60 million worth of bonds connected to an Indian tribe. One of the bank accounts that was used in that fraud was a bank account that Hunter Biden drew a lot of money from and a lot of foreign entities put a lot of money into. So just to give you an idea, over a 14-month period from 2014 through early 2016, while Joe Biden is vice president of the United States, a Ukrainian company called Burisma, it's controlled by a very corrupt oligarch, sends $3 million into this account. A Chinese government entity called Bohai Harvest, which is run by the Bank of China, sends $650,000 into this account. Keep in mind, this is only one account. We believe there are others. There are other cash transfers as well, Steve. There's $1.2 million that comes from some LLC from a small boutique Swiss bank. We don't know who's behind the LLC. The bank itself has been charged in 6 countries for money laundering, so that makes it kind of sketchy. There's $142,000 going into this account from the son-in-law of the former prime minister of Kazakhstan. So large amounts of foreign money flowing in, and the number one recipient of the cash coming out is the vice president's son, Hunter Biden.
It's so fascinating what you've unearthed here, because just, you know, all the focus, thanks to in large part to your research, really in the conversation around all this, has been the Clinton Foundation and that family and the corruption around the Clintons. But it's looking like the Bidens are operating by the same playbook, which is getting the family into all this business. And especially at a time when China, as we're now realizing almost daily, is not some kind of benign partner, but America's number one strategic rival. and yet they're doing business deals with the Chinese state. It's unbelievable while he's vice president.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right, Steve. I mean, we're all familiar with globalization and the phenomenon as it relates to the economy and corporations. Well, corruption is being globalized as well. You know, 70 years ago, foreign governments, a country like China or others were not quite as interested in every single thing that happens in Washington, D.C. Now what Washington, D.C. does can make you or break you, whether you're China, whether you're the Ukraine, you name it. So what do? They look for friends in Washington. And one of the best ways to make friends in Washington is to do deals with family members. You know, Joe Biden, every year as vice president, he has to disclose his income, assuming those disclosures are honest. He can't have a big fat check from the Chinese government in that disclosure form. But his adult son, Hunter Biden, he doesn't have to disclose anything. So, you know, as I recount in the book and we've talked about on your show, in December of 2013, Vice President Biden flies over on Air Force Two to Beijing, China. On the plane with him is Hunter Biden. They have a lot of meetings. Vice President Biden doesn't really challenge the Chinese on much of anything. 10 days later, when they return, Bohai Harvest, this company we're talking about, agrees to a $1 billion private equity deal with Hunter Biden's firm. And that's just one example of the sort of thing we're talking about.
And this guy, I mean, you know, he's a lot of people on the Democrat side are talking about him as their preferred candidate for president next time.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, going to be a central issue, because if you look at the trajectory of Joe Biden as vice president, he was essentially U.S. point person on Chinese policy, and he was widely criticized for going very soft on them as it related to the South China Sea. That's at the same time his son is getting large checks from the Chinese government. Joe Biden is also point person on U.S. policy towards Ukraine at the same time that his son is getting large checks from the Ukrainian government. And he's accused of looking the other way at fraudulent behavior and corruption within the government of Ukraine. While his son is getting paid, Vice President Biden makes 5 trips to Ukraine on very, very sensitive matters. And the suggestion that somehow, you know, he's not going to be sensitive to that fact is absolutely ridiculous.
Okay, so while the Senate impeachment trial continues this week, let's assume Trump is eventually acquitted by the Senate. The whole idea, as I've said, behind this sham impeachment process is to try to taint Trump with an aura of corruption and convince as many gullible voters as possible that Trump is, in fact, corrupt and should not be supported. Meanwhile, all the stuff about Joe Biden, do you hear much of it in the mainstream media? You can say what you want about what a fraud and sham the impeachment trial is, but I have no doubt that millions of Democrat dupes out there will swallow this idea hook, line, and sinker and vote faithfully for the Democratic presidential nominee in November. Question is, who will that be? It seems that Senator Crazy Bernie Sanders, longtime socialist and communist admirer from Vermont, whose net worth is several million dollars, is pulling ahead in some recent polls, though Joe Biden is still the leader in other polls. And Massachusetts Senator, Democrat Senator, Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren, also continues to make a strong showing. Here's a breakdown of 2 of the latest Democratic presidential polls out by Political Forecast Presidential Elections on YouTube. Play soundbite 5, please.
Hey guys, and welcome on in for today's video. Got a couple of polls that I wanted to touch on that came out over this past day. And if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, there's some really good news here for you. He's leading in both of these instances. And going to dive into the numbers. If you'd like to take a look at these polls for yourself, I'll link them down in the video description. Also, if you're new to the channel, welcome. Going to be continuing to go over polls and do election coverage and prediction videos. So if that's something that interests you, consider clicking that subscribe button. And these two particular polls, a lot of the data that was taken here was after this past debate that we just had. We have a national poll as well as a state-specific result looking at New Hampshire. So starting off here with the national poll, this is from Ipsos and Reuters. And Bernie Sanders continues to be the front runner in this particular national poll. He's leading the way at 20% of support. This is up a couple of points from where he was in last week's result from this resource. Joe Biden in second place, very competitive there at the top. With Sanders, he's bringing in 19%, and this is up 4 points from where he was a week ago. Also, Elizabeth Warren there in double digits at 12%. This is up a couple of points. Bloomberg, a pretty solid showing from him up there at 9 percentage points. This is up 3 points from where he was in the prior result. And then Pete Buttigieg is there at 6 percentage points. And it feels like a lot of the momentum that we saw from Pete Buttigieg and his campaign kind of swelled up through the month of November. But since that point in time, he's more leveled off or taken a step back. We see in this instance, he's in fifth place. He is up 1 point from where he was a week ago, grabbing that 6%. And kind of throughout this process over the past handful of months, we had Biden looking really strong, and then Elizabeth Warren kind of closed that gap through September into October, but she's significantly fallen back since then. And then we kind of had Pete Buttigieg had his strong moments through November, and then he took a bit of a step back. But then over the past couple of months, December into January is where Bernie Sanders has been taking a step forward and looking like he's going to be the most serious contender at the top along with Joe Biden. Something that is also worth noting about these Ipsos Reuters polls and why Sanders is doing a bit better in them than what we see in a lot of other national polls. And that's because they give the option of not being sure who your first choice is going to be. And since Bernie Sanders has the most committed supporters, it means that a smaller percentage of the people who are at least leaning towards him would be not sure or not having their mind up made at that point in time. So that is likely benefiting Sanders' numbers in terms of being at the top in this instance from these Ipsos Reuters polls. So then also moving on to the state-specific result out of New Hampshire. This is an Emerson poll, and this one was a sample size of 657. That national poll that we just took a look at, actually a similar sample size there at 681. Now, this is actually a pretty decent sample size for a small population state like New Hampshire, and we're seeing Bernie Sanders lead the way in first place at 23%. This is down 3 percentage points, actually, from where he was in the prior Emerson poll out of New Hampshire, and that was taken back in late November. Buttigieg also taking a step back, down 4 percentage points to 18%, whereas Biden and Warren staying steady each there at 14 percentage points. And these state-specific polls that we've been getting, specifically out of the first two areas of Iowa and New Hampshire, have shown a relatively competitive race at the top among the top four candidates. It's really anyone's game at this point, but if I had to handicap it, I'd say that Sanders has the advantage going into both Iowa and New Hampshire. We'll see if that changes or not as we continue to get these polls coming out here in the coming weeks, but this is crunch time. We're just a couple, 2 to 3 weeks away from actually heading into Iowa and getting real voting data back. And particularly for Sanders, if he's not showing strength out of the gate and able to pick up wins in areas like Iowa and New Hampshire, which should be relatively favorable towards him like it was back in 2016 in his matchup against Hillary Clinton, then we're going to get an indication very early on whether Sanders is going to be the real deal or not through this process. Specifically in a state like New Hampshire, it's neighboring to Vermont. He absolutely crushed it there in 2016. And if Sanders doesn't win New Hampshire, it would be a very negative sign for him to go on and have any chance at going on and winning the nomination, in my estimation. And this is also something that you can probably say for Elizabeth Warren, where if she isn't able to pick up a victory in New Hampshire, which is also the neighboring state to Massachusetts, that would also be a bad sign for her campaign.
Also recently, Biden, Sanders, Warren, and other Democratic presidential hopefuls had yet another televised debate, and it seems Warren became upset, claiming Sanders had declared that a woman could not be elected president. Sanders strongly denied this, but Warren supporters in the media were obsessed with it and gave it lots of coverage. Warren, by the way, was just endorsed by that bastion of leftism, the New York Times, and the fabulously wealthy leftist Jeff Zucker, head of CNN, also known as Communist News Network, which has been hosting these Dem debates. It is reported that Zucker is also backing Warren. Here's Fox's Greg Gutfeld's take on the latest Dem debate. Play soundbite 6, please.
If you had watched any of the Democratic debate, you'd think someone drugged your food. You'd find more signs of life on the moon. But the story is no longer about the forgettable candidates, but a network that once again inserts its own biases into the event. Here's CNN's Abby Phillip questioning Sanders and then Warren over Liz's accusation that Bernie said a woman couldn't win in 2020.
Senator Sanders, I do want to be clear here. You're saying that you never told Senator Warren that a woman could not win the election.
That is correct.
Senator Warren, What did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
I disagreed.
Perfect. Was that a question or an Abbott and Costello routine? That might be the funniest debate moment I've ever seen. One more time, please.
Senator Sanders, I do want to be clear here. You're saying that you never told Senator Warren that a woman could not win the election.
That is correct.
And Senator Warren, what did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
I disagreed.
I will never get sick of that. So once again, CNN intercedes on behalf of a candidate. Remember when Candy Crowley shielded Obama from Mitt and when Hillary got debate questions before facing Bernie? Now, I ain't no Bernie, bro. He's a socialist and spent his adult life on the wrong side of history. But that's unfair. And the Dems should be worried. Without original thinkers like Yang or Tulsi, those on stage seem bored by their own words. Biden disappeared into the podium as Tom Steyer stared at you like a glazed stalker on the subway. It seemed a group unprepared to face Trump. In fact, if you were some space alien and saw two screens, one with the debate and the other with the Trump rally, you'd think these events were beamed from two different planets, one populated by meek, insignificant creatures and the other ruled by fierce monsters with unusual hair. If I were that alien, I'd know which planet I'd happily invade and which one I'd steer clear of. Fact is, your party's in trouble when the most memorable moment comes from a moderator. I'd say CNN should be embarrassed, but, you know, that's impossible.
All humor aside, well, there's no doubt, despite all the horrific hatred of Trump in the mainstream liberal, that is, leftist-dominated media, and the desire by so many in the government and their education and social institutions to get rid of Trump by almost any means, there's no doubt Trump will nevertheless be a strong presidential contender in 2020. But what's of even greater concern to me is that too many Trump supporters and the Republican Party establishment seems to be ignoring, or at least badly underestimating, the enormous financial and political clout of the left in America today. Whatever happens in the presidential race, there are immensely powerful forces on the left working assiduously not just to undermine Trump with voters, but supporting leftist Democrats everywhere with vast sums of money and the staggering propaganda power of the mainstream media, along with social media and other social and educational institutions. As I say, these things, there are widespread ongoing voter registration drives underway across the country to get out the vote for Democrats and on Election Day next November. These efforts have been ongoing for some time. In a recent edition of the show, I mentioned reporting by the NewAmerican.com of the well-financed efforts of Maoists, some here in the U.S. and others residing in China, working diligently to get out the Democratic vote in Virginia, which paid off with that state turning overwhelmingly Democrat in elections there last year. And while we're on the subject of the left's political power in the U.S., let's not forget that communism, the most extreme form of leftism, socialism, is far from being dead, as the left-wing establishment has sought to convince Americans over the years. Here's audio from a video done by the NewAmerican.com's Behind the Deep State video series on the fake fall of communism with host Alex Newman. Play soundbite 7, please.
So we've been told endlessly over and over again that the powers that be in the Western world have always and everywhere been at war with communism, this mass murdering ideology, if you will, that really has its roots, centuries ago. In the principles of the Illuminati and Jacobinism, this idea that we're going to get rid of private property, abolish the family, build a world government, get rid of Christianity. These ideas have been around for a long time. And the truth is, when you think about the deep state, you need to realize that communism is really just one arm, one tool of this so-called deep state, this effort, this coalition, this cabal of people who seek to enslave humanity. So, the obvious place to start would be with the Bolshevik Revolution. We were told that, this ragtag group of nutty communists managed to overthrow the government and take over Russia. But the story is actually much more complicated. Probably the most important book on this subject was written by one of America's finest historians, Anthony Sutton, certainly one of the finest historians of the 20th century. And he explained in the book Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution that the leading financiers on Wall Street were actually responsible for financing and aiding and abetting the communist revolution in Russia. They were aiding and abetting the Bolsheviks. They helped pay Trotsky, and they helped foment revolution there for a very specific purpose. Further on, we saw that this subversive assistance to communists and to communist ideology and to communist criminals continued. In fact, during World War II, it really came out totally in the open. They started calling the mass murderer Joseph Stalin Uncle Joe, and we started building him factories so he could build tanks and airplanes and bombs and weapons under the guise of fighting another socialist, Adolf Hitler, the National Socialist in Germany. We literally built up the entire Soviet economy. We built up their war machine. We gave them all our secrets. We gave them food, we gave them supplies, weapons, everything you can imagine. And after World War II, this aid for communists and communism continued through subversives and members of the deep state within the U.S. government. For example, what happened in China, I think, is a really interesting example of this. You had subversives within the deep state, people in the Council on Foreign Relations orbit. You go back and watch our episode on Council on Foreign Relations if you're not familiar with this. But people like George Marshall, who served as Secretary of War, Defense, and State. And what they did was they deliberately betrayed our ally, Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist leader of the Chinese, who actually helped us in World War II, in favor of Chairman Mao. So they disarmed our ally. They aided and abetted Mao at every turn. They handed Manchuria over to the communists after World War II so that Mao could arm all of his forces with advanced Japanese weaponry. There's an amazing book about this, too. It's called May God Forgive Us Again by Robert Welch. If you haven't read that book, you really need to get it so you understand what happened in China. It is an abomination. It is an atrocity of immense proportions. Similar thing happened in Cuba. You know, the establishment, the deep state, told us that Castro was this freedom fighter. The New York Times said he was the George Washington of Cuba. You had subversives all up and down the State Department aiding and abetting Castro, turning against our former ally Batista. And, you know, they pretended like they didn't know he was a communist, but that's ludicrous. You had multiple American ambassadors warning the State Department that Castro and his band of thugs were communists. Actually, the U.S. ambassador to Cuba, Earl Smith, he wrote a whole book about how the U.S. government handed Cuba to the communists on a silver platter on purpose. Right, it was called The Fourth Floor. You can get a copy of it. It's a very, very interesting book. And what he reveals is that they knew and they deliberately handed power to Castro. In fact, he actually testified in the U.S. Congress under oath that we, as in the U.S. government, are responsible for bringing Castro to power. After that, then, of course, the communist Cuban government worked very actively to promote this terror, this communism in America. One of the things they did was work with the Weather Underground, the terror organization founded by Obama's buddy, Bill Ayers, and his wife, Bernadine Dorn. Both of them were involved in creating this terrorist group. They bombed the State Department. They bombed Pentagon. They bombed Congress. They bombed police departments. They bombed funerals of police officers that they murdered. And, of course, Obama later started his political career in the home of Bill Ayers. Of course, this all, furthering the agenda. Bill Ayers went into education. We actually had an FBI official who infiltrated the leadership of this terrorist group. His name was Larry Grathwall, and he explained that they were plotting to invite the Cubans, the Soviets, the Chinese into the United States. They were going to intern tens of millions of Americans and murder, exterminate tens of millions of Americans. You can watch the video. Here's Larry Grathwall.
The subject of what's going to happen after we take over the government. We become responsible then for administrating, 250 million people. And there was no answers. No one had given any thought to economics. How are you going to clothe and feed these people? The only thing that I could get was that they expected that the Cubans and the North Vietnamese and the Chinese and the Russians would all want to occupy different portions of the United States. They also believed that their immediate responsibility would be to protect against what they called the counter-revolution. And they felt that this counter-revolution could best be guarded against by creating and establishing re-education centers in the Southwest, where we would take all the people who needed to be re-educated into the new way of thinking and teach them how things were going to be. I ask, well, what is going to happen to those people that we can't re-educate, that are die-hard capitalists? And the reply was that they'd have to be eliminated. And when I pursued this further, they estimated that they would have to eliminate 25 million people in these re-education centers. And when I say eliminate, I mean kill 25 million people. Now, I want you to imagine sitting in a room with 25 people, most of which have graduate degrees from Columbia and other well-known educational centers, and hear them figuring out the logistics for the elimination of 25 million people. And they were dead serious.
We also had the major foundations, these massive tax-exempt foundations involved in this. Congress set up an investigation back in 1952 called the Reese Committee or the Cox Committee to investigate tax-exempt foundations. And the head of the Ford Foundation actually told Norman Dodd, the lead investigator, that what they were doing was trying to so alter life in the United States that it could be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union.
Raymond Gaither was at that time president of the Ford Foundation. And Mr. Gaither had sent for me when I found it convenient to be in New York, asked me to call upon him at his office, which I did. And on arrival, after a few amenities, Mr. Gaither said, "Mr. Dodd, we've asked you to come up here today because we thought that possibly, off the record, you would tell us why the Congress is interested in the activities of foundations such as ourselves." And before I could think of how I would reply to that statement, Mr. Gaither then went on voluntarily and stated, he said, "Mr. Dodd, all of us that have a hand in the making of policies here have had experience either with the OSS during the war or the European Economic Administration after the war. We've had experience operating under directives, and these directives emanate and did emanate from the White House. Now we still operate under just such directives. Would you like to know what the substance of these directives is?" And I said, "Yes, Mr. Gaither, I'd like very much to know." Whereupon he made this statement to me, namely, "Mr. Dodd, we are here operate on similar, in response to similar directives, the substance of which is that we shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union." Well, parenthetically, Mr. Griffin, I nearly fell off the chair.
And in the final report that this congressional committee put out, they said that these deep state foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie, etc., have actively supported attacks upon our social and governmental system, and they financed the promotion of socialism and collectivist ideas. In 1966, Carol Quigley, who was actually a mentor to Bill Clinton, put out a book called Tragedy and Hope. He was given the opportunity to examine the deep state's papers, and he actually agreed with them on many things. At least that's what he said, prior to the end of his life. And he wrote in his book, he said, quote, "There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the roundtable groups, has no aversion to cooperating with communists or any other group, and frequently does so." So here you have a smoking gun proof that the deep state was working with communists and frequently does so. Obama's director of the CIA, John Brennan. Now, here's a crazy story. You know, this guy admitted in comments to the Congressional Black Caucus before he realized Trump was going to be the president that he had voted for the Communist Party candidate in the 1970s in the presidential election. That was Gus Hall, who, of course, was a known puppet of the mass-murdering Soviet Union. And so, obviously, he got fired, and that was the end of that, right? Well, no. They promoted him up the ranks until he eventually became the head of the CIA. You had people like Leon Panetta, who ran the Department of Defense and the CIA. When he was in Congress, this guy voted supported aid to the Sandinistas, the mass murdering communists. He voted for most favored nation for the Soviet Union, most favored nation status. He voted to surrender the Panama Canal that we built to a pro-Soviet government. He had very close ties to the Marxist Institute for Policy Studies. And of course, none of this is new, right? Soviet defectors have exposed this, that they were collecting dues from high-ranking officials within the U.S. government. We had the Venona papers that were decrypted, outing about 200 deep state communists all up and down the government. You know, Joe McCarthy just didn't realize how many there were, right? We had people like Duncan Lee, the confidential assistant to the founder of the Office of Strategic Services. We had the head of the OSS Secret Intelligence Division. We had the head of the Latin American Division, which is how communism spread so rapidly throughout Latin America. And, you know, it was interesting. Somebody had accused, Dick Novak had accused the OSS, the precursor of the CIA, of being infiltrated by communists. And the president of the OSS Society, kind of an OSS veterans group, actually responded with a letter to the editor in the Washington Post. He said the OSS was not infiltrated by communists during the war. It hired them, right? It deliberately hired them. You have even members of the Rothschild. You know, when you think of the deep state, you think of the money men, you have people like the Rockefellers, people like the Rothschilds. Well, one of the leading Rothschilds is, of course, Baron Eric D. Rothschild right now. And a few years ago, we found out he was actively promoting fellow communist Irina Bokova of the Bulgarian Communist Party to serve as the next Secretary General of the United Nations. She was the leader of UNESCO, the UN's education arm at the time. And he signed an open letter saying this communist who faithfully served the mass murdering dictatorship there, her father was on the Politburo of the Bulgarian Communist Party. These people murdered hundreds of thousands of innocent people. Rothschild wanted her to serve as the next Secretary General of the UN. And of course, even the idea that communism collapsed and that the West won is not really true. We have some books by Anatoly Golitsyn, New Lies for the Old and the Perestroika Deception, where he predicted, even before it happened, a phony collapse of communism. You know, they had realized that communist quote-unquote ideology had been so discredited, but they weren't done with these people. Yeah, so what they did was they pretended like communism collapsed. This is what Anatoly Golitsyn said in his books, one of the most important defectors ever to the West. And you know, he said that at some point the Chinese, the Russians, and the other communists of the world will unite and try to enslave the world with the help of the United Nations in a second October revolution. So, folks, when you think of communism, you need to realize this is one arm of the deep state. It is murderous. It is evil. It flies in the face of everything good, everything that God has commanded. They want to institutionalize thievery. They want to abolish the family. They want to overthrow governments and create this global system. These are exactly the same goals that the Illuminati had back in the late 1700s. You can go back and watch the episode of Behind the Deep State that we did with that. So thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Alex Newman, your host at Behind the Deep State. Please like this video, share, subscribe, keep getting the word out. Help us get these videos out. People need to know this information. Thank you very much. I'm Alex Newman with The New American, and God bless.
Now he's, if I heard correctly, he's basically blaming the U.S. government, or at least officials within the U.S. government down through the decades, with the success of communist regimes around the world. I don't know that I 100% go along with that, but I would say that, at least based on what I know now, but I would say that there is probably some truth in it. I understand that J. Edgar Hoover was feeding Joe McCarthy, the supposed great terrible demagogue in the 50s during the Red Scare, was feeding him with secret surveillance audio tapes of a number of different communist, pro-communist people in Hollywood and so on. But yes, the newamerican.com, which puts out the Behind the Deep State video series, is an organization of the strongly anti-communist, anti-leftist John Birch Society, which has been vilified over and over down through the years since it was formed in the 1950s by the left through Hollywood, the mainstream media, and other progressive organizations, which have done everything they can to besmirch and discredit the John Birch Society. I don't necessarily agree with everything they say, but I find that much of what they talk about to be true, or at least has truth in it, and even if it is mixed with their opinions. And I recognize that if they are so reviled by the left, they must have something worthwhile to say. I'm not afraid to listen. My point here is we are badly underestimating the power of the left to sway elections and other things. it won't do much good to get Donald Trump reelected president if he's hamstrung and hobbled by a Democratic-controlled Congress and state and local governments across the country. Republicans have got to get going with a strong effort to win over more voters this November. This should involve a concerted get-out-the-vote drive by for Republicans, recruiting more pro-Trump Republicans or even Democrats, TV, radio, internet, and print publicity campaigns such as documentaries and other special programs to get out our message to voters, and careful monitoring of election processes and facilities to prevent vote fraud. I've talked about the findings, the conclusions of organizations like Judicial Watch that millions have, certainly hundreds of thousands, over a million or 2 million perhaps, non-citizens have voted in 2016, 2018. Why do you think the Democrats left is so concerned about anything that might require voter identification? We find that in areas where there is where there are Democratic strongholds, they have the weakest voter ID laws or none at all. The time to get going with all this is now before it's too late. That's it for another show. Hope you found it of interest. Look for us 2 weeks from today in this same time slot, and have a good evening.